Welcome to the Movies on the Brain podcast. I'm one of your hosts, Brian C. Wood. And gathered with me this evening in this fine house of ill repute, the sequel
is Stephen Beecham.
Welcome back to the podcast, Stephen. It is good to see you and good to be here. We actually got an opportunity to sit in a movie theater for the first time in a year
and, it's been a minute.
And see a movie. What were your thoughts going into a theater where you had to wear a mask, eat popcorn, and be surrounded by complete and total strangers?
I was so excited to be back. I wasn't worried one bit. You know, I'm not saying I don't take any of this stuff seriously. And it was nice to see them do some social distancing in the theater and still manage to get a decent crowd. But I've missed it, you know. I got my sound bar and my big screen here in the living room, but there are some movies that you just, in state the obvious here, you got to see it in the theater. And Kong and Godzilla, man, I mean, that's where you got to see it.
Yeah, they've made it an event, and we haven't really had an event probably since Rise of Skywalker. Birds of Prey was okay, but no one, the marketing wasn't done right for that movie, and like the only people who really turned out to see it were Harley Quinn fans. But like, that's it. Like, you have to go all the way back to Christmas 2019 for an event like this. And Warner's, to their credit, even with the HBO Max component of it, were able to make this an event and marketed it in a very successful way over the last 4 weeks, where 4 to 6 weeks, where you felt like you had to go, to a theater and see it. And so I think that that's absolutely a credit to their marketing department, but also just a credit to us as, you know, a movie-going public that we were finally ready to get back in the theater for something. Because, you know, Tenet didn't do it. Wonder Woman 84 didn't do it. And really, I think the only thing that's changed since July or December has been vaccination rates. That's about the only thing that's changed. And also, I don't really feel like you needed to see Wonder Woman 84 on a huge screen.
No, Tenet for sure. No, I mean, it was nice. It was nice to get back, but I didn't even go. You know, I wasn't running out to see that one. This one, yes. Well, the next one, it would have been either this one or James Bond to get me back in the theater.
I don't know. I think you are of a generation where Mortal Kombat is a thing
right.
That resonates a lot.
High school, yeah.
Right. So I think that Warner Brothers film might have enticed you later in the month. But like, I was genuinely surprised that in an auditorium of 300, we were able to cram 180 in with distancing, and people were cheering and people were laughing and marking out on the side of you. And doing all the things that made it feel like we were back in normal, quote unquote, normal times. And I didn't know that they would be able to achieve that this quickly.
They nailed it. Yeah, that guy next to me was he was cutting up. He was having a good old time. And this is the type of movie, this is the full experience type of movie. I mean, it's just a popcorn flick. You're there just to kick back, have a good time. Everybody was thrilled to be back. Lots of excitement in the theater, and I was surprised when you told me the final head count in there. It didn't feel like we were jammed in there, but there was plenty of people.
And in a 300-seat auditorium, you have room to spread out 180 people. Mm-hmm. It's like, you know, you put 10,000 people in the Superdome. I mean, it just, you know, they're going to be plenty spaced out, and they'll still try to make noise, but it won't look or feel the same, you know?
Felt good.
But this felt good because it was 180 in a 300-seat auditorium. Seats were cut off for distancing reasons. And it just, everything worked well. I feel like this was different from Tenet. And though Tenet was like shot on IMAX. And Nolan is a big film head. And like he wants everybody to go to the theater and have this experience. I wasn't drawn out because I love Christopher Nolan by any stretch, but like, I didn't feel the need to be there, and I felt the need to be here this time. And, okay. And I'm interested to see if these numbers continue to go up They keep making more profit. What does this do for, you know, if Kong versus Godzilla can do this right now, this week, what would Black Widow have done in 6 weeks when they were prepared to go on May 5th?
Yeah.
Because Disney pulled back and went back 2 months again to July because they were afraid. And no one to this point had proven that you could make money at the box office. And now here we are post Kong Godzilla, or Godzilla versus Kong, if I want to be technical. And, you know, now we know people will show up.
I don't think AMC was quite ready, judging from the long lines we saw in there for concessions and just to get to scan your tickets to get in. There was nobody taking tickets at the front. I don't think they expected a crowd. And people are ready to go back. I'm with you. I said it earlier. I didn't care to run out and see Tenet. I mean, I guess they thought Nolan would be a draw, but
Nolan certainly thought he would be a draw.
Yeah, I mean, I know he wants everybody. He's a purist, let's say. But the popcorn movie brought him out, buddy. And you know, yeah, Black Widow would have crushed it. That would have been
the official welcome back to summer movie.
You know, it's going to be huge.
Yeah.
You know, when is it again?
Now it's July, but it was going to be, they moved. Like, they were debating what to do, and now they're gonna do the day and date in July. But, man, like, after seeing what I saw and experiencing what I experienced this weekend, it really made me think that Disney, for once, was gun-shy and didn't roll the dice, because if they'd have rolled the dice, I think it would have paid off in a huge, huge way for them.
More theaters, you mean? More show times? I think you're partly right with the vaccination rate getting up there. I think people are not only eager to get out and see stuff, but they're more willing now. People are feeling safer. I mean, we're making progress there. And one of the things, I mean, going to see family was huge on everybody's list. Getting out and seeing, doing restaurants again. But the movies was, a not so distant third with that. Everybody likes their movies. And that was one of the things I kept hearing over and over. People wishing they could go to the movies. It's not just us who likes to go see.
Right.
I mean, people do that all the time.
And it's an ecosystem thing that, like, it's a symbiotic relationship, right? Studios and movie theaters. So theaters have been open, quote unquote, since July of 2020. But studios have withheld so much product from them that pretty much since last October, it's Tenet and Wonder Woman. And outside of that, it's Hocus Pocus. It's second run movies. And like, I'm sorry, but I'm not going to leave my home to go see Hocus Pocus on the big screen.
Mm-hmm. And I forgot to mention that. You served it up for me, but there's going to be a lot of people who don't care to just watch it on HBO Max. They're going to go. I like watching stuff at home, but I hope they start doing more theater releases and forget about trying to do the simultaneous release. Or what's Black Widow going to do? Did you say
$30 premium on Disney Plus? Mm-hmm. So you have your Disney Plus subscription, and then you pay them $30 for the right to have Black Widow to yourself for 2 months. Whereas you can pay, you know,
that's a little different. If the enthusiasm at the movie theater that we saw continues, I don't think they'll have to do all that. And none of this releasing at the same time or release in the theater and wait 30 days and then put it on HBO. I mean, let's just put it in the theaters.
I think that we're stuck with that model for the rest of 2020. And I think that theatrical windows will now shorten. I think it'll be 30 to 45 day windows now, from the time that you debut in the theater to the time that you're on your streaming service, just simply because of the importance of the streaming services to these companies. Disney has made Disney Plus priority number one in their entire, you know, portfolio. Like, their whole focus and drive has been Disney Plus. AT&T is doing the same thing with Warner Media with HBO Plus. The reason we got the Snyder Cut is because they're trying to drive eyeballs. It's the reason they're doing this whole simultaneous release strategy. Like, they're not charging a premium price for those movies on HBO Max. All you have to do is have the $16.99 a month subscription.
I'm also, yeah. I don't mean to cut you off, but I'm also thinking like a, you know, I'm just a single guy. What if you got a family of five, six? Right. You know how expensive? Mm-hmm. I mean, how much were our drinks and candy the other night?
Right.
Not to mention the tickets.
Right.
You know, that's a major outing for a family.
And it's far cheaper for a family to pay $30 to see Black Widow and for as many times as they want for 2 months, whereas they would pay probably $200 to bring a family of four with kids to the movies to see Black Widow.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
all those kids need their own popcorn. Right. They're not sharing.
No. So
they need their candy and their drinks.
Right. So that drives the price tag up. So it for some, it will be more economically affordable to just do the Disney Plus thing.
Yep. I missed that whole part of the market just in my longing to get back to the theater. But there were families in the theater. Okay. We saw kids.
There were kids. There were families. As I said, they did an amazing job in the marketing on this one. Mm-hmm. That just, it grabbed you and they played up the scale of it. And they really made you feel like you had to see this on the biggest screen of them all. And I'm glad that we did. And I'm glad that, you know, I saw Wonder Woman 84 in a theater and then I came back and I watched it on HBO Max. I mean, it's good to have that option, especially when you do a podcast where I don't have to spend $15 every time I want to see the thing. I can pay my $15 once, then I can come back and on HBO Max and I can rewatch it so I can have more detailed thoughts. But it's going to be interesting to see how these box office numbers affect things going forward.
Yeah. Well, hopefully, I mean, how long have they been talking, damn near a year now, about the death of the movie theater?
Well, they've been talking about the death of the movie theater for 5 years.
Probably because the concessions and everything are so damn expensive. Well, they've sort of made their own bed, didn't they?
Well, they made their own bed in a couple of different ways. One of them is the studios get the majority of the profits from ticket sales. I can tell you that when I purchased my ticket for Phantom Menace, I paid $5.25 for a matinee. I go to AMC on Blue Bond here right now on a midday, and I'm going to pay $11.25.
Yeah.
And that's not even IMAX or Dolby or any of the large format, premium formats. I'm going to pay like $11. Then the movie theater makes all of its money from concessions. They make 2% of every ticket sale. So they make almost all of their money off concession sales. Well, if you're making none from ticket sales, you've got to make that up in concession sales. And that's why you get, that's why you get the young 16, 17, 18 year olds hitting you up to upgrade to a large because they get rewarded for upselling.
Yeah. My $7 drink.
Right. Because that's where they make their money. And that is, the two of them have essentially priced themselves out of the market because they allowed a place or a space for Netflix, for Disney Plus, for HBO Max, for, you know, okay, so I can pay $15 a month for HBO Max. I have this great back catalog of amazing Warner Brothers movies. And when new movies come out, I'll have them immediately on my television screen. Yeah, sign me up. $15 per month versus $15 a pop to go to the theater plus concessions.
I think in the long run, that access to the movies immediately is going to be a problem for the theater. As much as we like to go and as much as everybody in the theater enjoyed themselves, not every movie, as we just talked about, is going to be run out to the theater and see it.
Well, I mean,
there's going to be a lot of missed opportunities.
Well, just look at what they've done so far. Judas and the Black Messiah is an Oscar contender. But it would not have made a ton of money at the box office, but it was available day and date on HBO Max. And I can personally tell you that I've known more people who've seen that movie than would normally have seen it because it was on HBO Max. A Tom and Jerry animated movie. Great for kids and families, right? You don't necessarily have to spend all that money to take your kids to the theater if it's right there on your television. Now, Warner Brothers Media has already said that they will rescind this policy starting in 2021. It's only a 2020 policy, but they've also said that they're going to limit their theatrical window to 45 days. And so when a movie debuts in a theater, 45 days later, it's on HBO Max now, that, or at least in some like direct to video thing. But the reason for that is if you look at the math, the majority of the ticket sales, the majority of the money a movie makes in its first 3 weeks.
Yeah.
just because of the competitiveness of the marketplace, where you have a new big thing opening every week. So,
well, you used to.
Used to. But, yeah, it'll be interesting to see. So, let's talk about our movie, Kong versus Godzilla, or Godzilla versus Kong, whichever team you're on, however you want to phrase that. Uh-huh. So let's talk overall about our thoughts on the movie, just generally, broadly speaking. Because I know my biggest takeaway was that all the reviews were absolutely right in that this is not a human-based story.
Yep.
And human-based characters make no goddamn sense, and they do stupid shit, and they overact, and it's just bad. But it brought me... Honestly, you want to know what I thought of when I was sitting there watching with the two of us? I was thinking Armageddon. I was thinking about sitting in a theater... sitting in a theater in the late 90s, watching a Bruce Willis, Ben Affleck, oil rig workers go to an asteroid and try to blow it up. Saddam Hussein be bombing us... Like,
don't overthink it.
Yeah, like I'm just sitting there, like, this is awesome because, like, that's all that the movie is nonstop mayhem action that makes absolutely no sense. That the federal government would go to a bunch of oil workers and be like, "Hey guys,
that was a hilarious premise, but entertaining as hell." Which,
I mean, anytime you put together a cast that includes Ben Affleck, Bruce Willis, and Steve Buscemi,
big fan of his. Yeah, I loved the movie. I didn't go in there expecting a ton. I just wanted to have fun. I wanted to get back.
I don't think you had as much fun as the guy sitting next to you, but you had fun.
No one in the theater did. Of course, he had to be right next to me.
Yeah.
But, yeah, give me the monsters. I don't care about the people, you know? Giant special effects, explosions, monsters running, rampaging through the city.
The only thing you were missing was an Aerosmith song. And you were right back in the 90s. And I'm fine with it. Like, this for this little thing, it works.
They gave me exactly what I wanted.
Right. And this is entirely different from The Mummy. Like, the whole Monsterverse that they were going to do with Tom Cruise's Mummy and The Invisible Man and Javier Bardem and Angelina Jolie. That Mummy movie is horrible.
Well, they shoehorned too much time in there.
Right.
I want to see The Mummy. Tom Cruise, I've seen before. I mean,
right.
A little bit, that's fine. And they got it right with Kong versus Godzilla. Those are the ones I wanted to see. I like that it was heavy on my King Kong. I sense you're the Godzilla fan, just like the other guy next to me was.
So for me, I've seen Godzilla done once really, really well in my life, and that was Garris movie in 14. I don't count the abomination that was the reptilian lizard that lays eggs at Madison Square Garden.
The Ferris Bueller meets Godzilla.
Yeah. The only good thing that came out of that movie was the cup holder from Taco Bell and the Puff Daddy song. That was about it. I rocked out to that Puff Daddy song a lot as a kid. But I mean, I've seen it done once really well, and Kong I hadn't seen done well until Skull Island, because the only other Kong movie in my life is Peter Jackson's unwieldy, big, bloated 2005, Naomi Watts version.
I was all about that, too. I was so disappointed. I mean, it was fun, too, but it just didn't hit the spot like this one did.
It showed so many of the signs of what would come with him, with the just too much CGI, not enough character development.
Overdone. Everything was overdone. Just a little too much cheese. I like it to be just cheesy enough. Like Kong putting his shoulder back in after all the wrestling moves Godzilla was throwing down on him. I mean, that was just... I like how they got right to it. You didn't have to sit around and wait. Was that... Which one? It was the Matthew Broderick one that you didn't see Godzilla for...
No, that was the Gareth one where where he played peekaboo with him.
Mm-hmm.
And you didn't see him till the end when he fights the monsters and then rips one of their heads off and breathes atomic fire down their throat.
I need it right up front.
Right.
Just serve it up.
Especially in this format.
Yeah.
Especially in this format.
Yeah, give it to me immediately.
So let's talk about our good, our bad, and our not so good then. What was your good about this movie, Steven? I know you've kind of touched on broad strokes, but what's your good?
I like the pace and how it, I mean, just what I was just talking about. Immediately, the movie kicks off. And it kept up the pace pretty well. I didn't ever get bored. I wasn't like, okay, what is this? Show me the next month. I mean, there was always a little something to chew on. And with different monsters. It wasn't just Kong and Godzilla. There was the, what do they call it, the Hollow World monsters. There was,
there was the
I don't want to get too far ahead of
that. Yeah, there were the Hollow Earth monsters. There were other, but I love that the movie starts mid-res with Godzilla sensing that they're up to some bad shit. And he's going to come take them out before they can complete their bad shit.
Yeah. You know, I've been thinking about that for a while. How does he know these things? He just got a sixth sense, huh? Part of the mystery because of being one of the Titans.
He's supposed to be a Titan who is a guardian and protector of the realm. And if you are a guardian and protector of the realm, you know when threats are out there. And Titans themselves aren't a threat because they have all bowed down to him and become subservient to him as king
of the monsters.
After he defeated Ghidorah with the help of Mothra.
Yeah, I mean, I guess he's got to know somehow. He only comes out whenever it's time to battle.
Right.
Yeah.
Which is a thing that I like. What else was your good?
I was wondering at first, we were based in Pensacola, and I'm thinking, we're going to have a Godzilla movie in Pensacola? Then eventually they got me turned around, and we ended up back in Tokyo, where we belong. Got the all the neon lights going on.
No, Hong Kong.
Oh, it was Hong Kong. That's right, not Tokyo. Of course, we got to, what was I thinking? You got to catch that other market.
Yep.
It was getting a little close to the Pacific Rim with some of that,
neon lighting.
The super colors. Yeah, but hey, I like Pacific Rim too. Why not?
I liked the fact that they went out of their way to show that they were evacuating people.
Oh, that's right.
I loved the fact that, like, Snyder has been hammered so badly for his DC movies, like, not evacuating anybody. Like, even Michael Bay will, like, show you evacuating Chicago before he has the Transformers going in.
Yeah, because they level the city.
Right. And then,
which is also what you want to see.
Right. And then Snyder's just like, nope, I'm just going to sit here and let travelers be, you know, traversing the city so Zod can hold them hostage.
Yeah.
Those poor travelers, those poor tourists had to watch Superman break Zod's neck.
I guess it's okay when Godzilla torches all of Pensacola because it was just that one
Air Force evil base. Yes, the those one were the lab
bad guys. Yeah,
the one lab
was rooting against.
But
those
then,
guys.
But then again, they're also the alarm had sounded and they were evacuating. They were evacuating that base because old conspiracy theory boy was running in there when everybody else was running out.
He's got an odd sense of timing.
He's got a lot of odd things about him, but.
Yeah, that guy was all right. I love that Hollow World. I wish I would have liked to seen more of that. But hey, maybe that opens the door for more later.
It does. It does. Definitely does. And Hollow Earth is a concept they introduced in King of the Monsters because you have to have a legitimate reason of like where they're like, okay. So Godzilla is going from the Pacific, like the Indonesian Sea, and like 18 minutes later, he's in Hawaii. Like, how are we doing this? How's this working? And the answer is a series of interconnected tunnels that have been around since the beginning of time that are the Hollow Earth. And he uses the Hollow Earth to travel and traverse the world, meeting his threats. And so that's something that they introduced in King of the Monsters, and they just exponentially grew as from a small idea to like this whole nother world that, you know, has sunlight in the middle of the core of the earth.
It was awesome.
It was.
I like, yeah, I mean,
and
I guess
that's the part of the movie you have to see in on the big screen.
And I guess even with my popcorn movies, I do like a little bit of, I don't know, let's call it, maybe not call it realism, but it was kind of weird. Okay, you're all the way in Hawaii in the snap of a finger. You know, don't take me out of the movie that much.
And this helps that.
Yeah.
And it's a beautifully, like, whenever I've read Journey to the Center of the Earth, that's what I've always thought of. It's like these beautiful paradises and things, and the way that they lit it, and the creatures that inhabited it, and you know, the fact that Kong's relatives had come from there, and that Godzilla's relatives had come from there, and that they had battled for eons. It added so much layer and context to it that I really enjoyed. And it was beautifully shot too.
Yeah.
Like from the you know, gravity defying ways you get in there to just to the end, it was just beautifully shot.
Yeah, some of that camera work during the gravity scenes had me a little turned around. They did it really well, but then they slowed it down perfectly for all the monster fights. I got to see everything happen. No Transformers.
Can't tell one robot from another.
Yeah.
And I also like the fact that the majority of the fights are well lit. Like they're you know, even when they're underwater in the first initial encounter, you can still very visibly see where each other is in relation to the other. One is in relation to the other.
Yep.
And you get the geography, and the choreography stays with you. And that's just a whole other world from like King of the Monsters, where everything's so dark. You know.
Yeah, I guess they're trying to take some shortcuts to make the effects look better.
Yeah.
They nailed it with this one. I mean, the monsters look great. It's all about the monsters, right?
Right.
I'm a broken record. And yeah, I didn't think about that, but yeah, there was. At the end of the fight, it was in the morning light.
Mm-hmm. The only time you see Godzilla in broad daylight in Garris's movie is at the end, where he's walking back into the sea.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
his job is done.
Right. any other goods that you had?
Well, I guess I'm looking forward, but they left just enough unanswered for me to want to see. If they're going to put out another one, I want to see it again. The Hollow Earth.
Kong's new home.
Yeah, his new home that wasn't explained much, and he's got, you know, he's got that axe that draws the power from the radiation of the Earth, and he puts it in that special slot, and it... There's got to be more to that.
An axe...
We got a tip of the iceberg there.
An axe formed out of the mm-hmm. back of a Godzilla.
Mm-hmm.
Out of a Godzilla spine.
I'd like to see more about how those two titans clashed in the first place. Some backstory there. I mean, Godzilla to me was always in the ocean, not Hollow Earth. I mean, when did the first scrap start?
Right, and
some of that. In this new universe.
In this new universe, it opens up a whole new world of possibilities mm-hmm. with these being the ancient titans.
Mm-hmm.
And I get excited about that because it means that Toho has been very pleased with what they've been doing. Toho continues to grant licenses. We can get more Mothra and Rodan type creatures, which would be nice.
Yeah, you think they'll go outside the box and do some new creatures?
Well, they did for the original. For the Godzilla 14, they didn't have the licenses to any of Toho's monsters. So they had to create the Cujo or the Manjo or whatever they called them.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm also interested in what they do, where they go from here, because part of my not so good and my bad is also related to that. So we'll get into that.
All right, let's go.
But my good would absolutely be the way that the shots are shot.
Mm-hmm.
I love the, you know, oddly enough, probably my favorite fight is the first one, because I like the fact that Kong is literally tied down. Like, he can't defend himself. The freaking humans realize, hey, maybe we need to release him and let him go help us and defend us. Nah, it's okay. Everything will be fine. Meanwhile, Kong's drowning and getting his ass kicked. And it's like, come on, dude.
I was right there with you. That was some of my not so good, is watching these humans bumble every decision they've got to make.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess you got to transport him somehow. You can't just let him loose.
Well, and boats have always been a thing with Kong. Kong has always been transported by boat. Even in the rudimentary, how many times have we retold that story of him taking over New York?
Mm-hmm.
You know, so boats and chains and those things are all Kong-related mythos, and you have to do them. But, like, at least have the smarts enough to be like, maybe we should let him out of these when we know the giant lizard is coming after us.
Well, they had him on the boats. They had him swatting at the planes. I mean, you got to get it in there.
Yeah.
It's not Kong without it.
But,
yeah,
I mean...
I knew my boy Kong was about to get...
Walloped.
Get his ass handed to him when he's trying to fight Godzilla in his territory.
Yeah. But that's the funny thing. The director had said there had never been a water fight. Godzilla,
sure
even, even in all the Toho movies, has never conducted a battle in the ocean. So he wanted to do that because it's never been done before, and he did it brilliantly. So I love the way that first fight is shot. I love the underwater. Again, the geography of it, making sure your audience isn't lost. You know where both guys are. You have the realism of Kong literally coughing up water on the aircraft carrier because he almost drowns. I enjoy all of those things. The shot that's in the trailers of the atomic fire and all of that onto the aircraft carrier, it's all awesome. And then the one where he grabs the plane and the dude ejects himself out,
yeah,
only to be caught, and it's
they throw the plane into Godzilla.
Yeah, it's really awesome, and I enjoyed that first fight a lot. Another good of mine would be the score. I thought the score was equal to these two legends. I thought they used the hints of both of the original themes from the two previous movies, but I thought that the bass and the drums and everything like really met with what these two beings are and what kind of a mega fight you're trying to display here.
Oh yeah.
And lastly, my last thing that I would say would definitely have qualified as my good is the way that they shot the gravity defying sequence going into the Hollow Earth, because like it brought me back to Interstellar. We're sitting here talking about Nolan. We've got a Nolan movie on back. And anybody who listens to this podcast knows my feelings on Nolan. But Interstellar is my favorite Nolan film because I feel like it's the film that has the most heart. Even though, you know, Matthew McConaughey does, you know, go all the way back home to get to his grown-up daughter, sees that his grown-up daughter's okay, and then is like, bye, I'm going to go back now. Like, I was only here for like 15 minutes, but bye.
Yeah.
You know, but that's Nolan. Nolan hasn't really, like, emotion is not a thing in Nolan's films. Like, that's just not the kind of filmmaker he is. Whereas somebody like J.J. or Spielberg has that in spades. The way it was shot, the way that the gravitational pull looked on the actors, the way they were reacting to it, all of the things, it very much felt like a quantum physics space sci-fi thing in the middle of this giant fantasy movie, which I really loved.
I was impressed with that too. And I liked that the camera got you just turned around to where you could just turned around enough to where you couldn't quite figure out what was going on and which way was up without making you want to close your eyes and stop looking at the screen. Because sometimes they take that way too far.
But you know what it made me think of, honestly? It made me feel like we were in one of the, was that the journey into the body ride at Disney
those
World?
Those 3D things?
Yeah. Like the old school Honey, I Shrunk the Kids in 3D. Like that's what it,
yeah,
that's what it felt like. It felt like one of those Disney, Disney World rides where you're strapped into the thing and it's moving around you.
That's for sure.
That's what it felt like. And that's the immersive experience I want from this kind of film.
I hear that.
So what were your not so good, sir?
Well, I guess I'll have to start with my boy Kong never did beat Godzilla. He got his ass whooped twice.
And submitted.
That was painful for me. I mean, it you know, he came through at the end there, but I'm too much of a King Kong fan to watch him just get completely mauled. I mean, he didn't have much of a chance, even with a weapon.
Mm-hmm.
So, what do you think about... I don't want to say it not so good, but I hadn't thought about the sign language, you know, and the communicating with Kong. I wonder, why did it take so long for Hollywood to put that in?
I think...
I mean, other than rudimentary communication, right. Now they're talking about this is where your family lives. Okay, this is the real Mechagodzilla is the real enemy. You know, it was just a lot more.
I love the fact that I think if I remember correctly, Jackson had touched on some of this and tried to like maybe hint at some of it, but like this makes perfect sense because the one human character in the goddamn movie is the one who's talking to him. But like,
well, in the past it had just been the damsel in distress, right, or the pretty girl. She led him along to do whatever.
Right. But
now it's a little more involved.
But the fact that there were, and I think where that changes is the fact that in Skull Island, it is established that there are Aborigines people on the island. There are natives of the island. Now, one of my not so goods, and I'll get into this in a minute, is the fact that they don't really explain a lot about Skull Island. They just are like, oh, some random storm happened to start taking over the island, so we built a containment chamber for Kong.
Yeah.
Like, they don't really go into, like, because when we leave Kong, you know, he's a young kid in the 1970s. By the time we get to him now, he has gray in his beard and he's, you know, decidedly older.
I did catch that during the movie, but I didn't put it in my notes.
Yeah, but that's a designed thing because he was still growing it on Skull Island. But yeah. Like,
how long has he been there?
Well, we know that he was born on Skull Island. But like, the thing is, like you establish in Skull Island that there was an Aborigines people. She is one of them. It is made clear that Rebecca Hall's character adopted that little girl. But the reason that little girl can, I think, communicate with Kong is because she is one of the peoples, and that the peoples would have had a way to communicate with Kong. I mean, remember the scene in Skull Island where they have the Church of Kong. Like, they have the paintings of Kong everywhere. Yeah.
I guess I just had it in my head, even in that movie, that it was always they were sacrificing things to him.
Afraid of him.
Yeah, not communicating, just
reverent
keeping
fear.
Keeping him satisfied.
Happy, yeah.
I kind of like that twist.
Yeah.
I know we were talking about the not so good, but I guess my not so good about it was, why did you wait so long, Hollywood, to put that in there? I mean, we've had Coco the gorilla.
Mm-hmm.
With all the sign language for quite a while. I know this is a minor thing, but I guess this is part of going to a monster movie, but watching Kong eat sloppily, you know, chew all these fish up on the boat and rip the head off that monster and suck the guts out of it, eat out of the decapitated head of this.
This is coming from a man who was very upset by the fact that the Star Wars universe felt the need to explain where blue milk came from in The Last Jedi.
I didn't like the blue milk either.
A film that, you know, I know you love so much. But,
yeah, the eating, yeah, I don't need that. I don't need any of that in my movies.
Yeah. I like it because it helps establish the primate in him. And you remember, like, Godzilla rips the head off of his Koju in the Godzilla 14 movie. And then, like, he breathes into the head. He takes the head. He rips it off. He breathes fire down the neck. The body falls to the ground. And he lifts the head up. So it was kind of like an echo of that kind of thing. Although Godzilla didn't eat the tentacles of the thing and suck its blood.
Nasty.
But I think that's part of the thing. To be primate and to be primal and nasty is kind of the point of that scene.
I mentioned that earlier, Kong throwing his shoulder out and putting it back in.
I love that because it shows the so, like, again, you both love Star Wars.
Yeah.
One of the things that I loved about Rise of Skywalker, and Lord knows I didn't like a lot, was the intensity of that fight between Kylo Ren and Rey on the remains of the fallen Death Star 2. Because it's one you can see. And it's the first, one of the few times, if ever, in a Star Wars film, you can see the physical and emotional toll it's taking on those two to be exercising these powers against one another, to be soaked in water and being able, having to run this fast and move and cut and do all these things. Like, it actually gives you a physical sense of the toll it takes to be a Jedi in battle. And I loved that what they did with the Kong versus Godzilla is they don't just magically heal from their injuries.
Yeah.
Like, they actually sustain injuries in the course of defending the planet. And they're not Superman. They're not Iron Man. Like, they're not, like, superhuman. They actually do get bloodied up and injured. And I love that just that little small scene of popping that shoulder back into place shows you that he paid an actual physical price for doing what he did.
They both did.
Which, you know, adds to the realism of the fight, which is what you're trying to do. You're trying to sell these guys as having literally beaten the shit out of each other.
Well, they definitely did. I don't know why that annoyed me so much. It just took me out of the movie for a second. I mean, I'm as much in the movie as I could be in a Kong versus Godzilla. And like I said, you got to have just a certain amount of cheese. I don't know.
And it's played for laughs. That scene is played for laughs, but it also serves the story purpose of helping you to realize that he's actually taking a toll, which makes what he does at the end even more important, that he's, you know, mentally and physically taxed, yet he finds the strength to help Godzilla at the end.
After they restart his heart.
Right.
Which, maybe it's because I'm such a fan. I didn't want him to be half dead.
Which again is a play on something they did in King of the Monsters, where they have to go down into Godzilla's lair and set off a nuke to re-energize him so he can go and meet Ghidorah at the end. Because Ghidorah gets the best of him in the first round, and his energy is just wiped. And so he goes home to hibernate, and they don't have time for him to hibernate. So the humans decide they're going to swim a little nuclear weapon in there and restart him up and re-energize him. And so that was a play on that, where it's like, again, restarting the heart. You know, we need something the size that would light Vegas up for a week, which was a nice callback to earlier in the film, which is, I love when films do that, as you know. Like, oh, you told me that an hour and a half ago, and now it's relevant. Mm-hmm. Awesome.
Like the whiskey he pours in the... under the computer to break the satellite link for Mechagodzilla.
Mm-hmm. Or a blowtorch that, you know, magically comes back at the end and kills a couple of hippies in Once Upon a Time. Yeah.
Oh, man, that was such a great... Watching you watch that was great. Speaking of that nuclear breath, I mean, Godzilla... Kong puts that mysterious axe in the mysterious slot, and Godzilla knows it right away and decides to...
rip a hole in the earth.
Right. I'm thinking to myself, man, that's some powerful stuff. I don't know how... I mean,
again, it's him sensing threats. And a Kong with that particular weapon...
Okay, there you go.
A Kong with that particular weapon, which obviously has history with them and their families, mm-hmm. he would sense that immediately as, okay, now I've not just got one threat, I've got two. Because not only do I have these humans trying to do this stupid shit with this robot, I also got Kong. And that's why you hear our good friend Rebecca Hall be so stern and ardent about not letting Kong off the island to her African-American colleague. You know, but when the blonde-haired blue guy shows up and is like, maybe we should take him off the island, she just is all about it.
Yeah.
But like...
that was a quick...
But like, her whole deal is, if we take him off this island, Godzilla will sense him and will come for him. And that will not be good. And that's her whole deal, is because they're ancient enemies, ancient rivals. He will sense and he will come. And that's exactly what he does. It's the same thing when Kong picks up the axe. He knows immediately, now I've got another threat on my hands.
Well, kind of along with that, when I was watching the movie, I thought this would be one of my not-so-goods, was after Kong's defeat on the aircraft carrier, and they trick, I'm using my air quotes here, y'all, they trick Godzilla into thinking that he had given up, or that he was defeated, and Godzilla just swims away. I remember thinking, what the hell is this about? They tricked him. It was the submission. They don't fight to the death. They just fight till... I didn't realize.
And they reiterate that multiple times. Who's going to submit to... like, Rebecca Hall's character again says, because she has a whole lot of exposition to do, that's basically her whole character, but that they have to... they will keep going until one submits to the other. And ultimately they do. I mean, Kong ultimately does submit after three brutal rounds of fighting with Godzilla.
Mm-hmm. I saw it.
Does ultimately submit, but they reconcile that at the end with him helping Godzilla and Godzilla and him forming some kind of truce. The whole playing dead thing because you're not even really doing that for Kong's sake. You're doing it for your own sake because you're worried about your own ship sinking because Godzilla is just mucking everything
up. Yeah, that battle was over before it started with Godzilla in the water.
He's chained up on a boat. He's literally got two hands tied behind his back. What's he supposed to do?
And somebody says, let him go, and they say, no, we can't do that. I mean, come on. Yes, you absolutely. He's your only chance.
Well, to be fair, she was saying, dump the monkey. Like, pitch him overboard, and let's get the hell out of here.
The evil guy's daughter.
Right, the hot Asian chick.
Yeah.
Like, that's literally her description.
That's all she was.
That's the description in the casting sheet. Hot Asian girl.
Mm-hmm. Who acts like a bitch later.
Yes, who gives the girl from Parasite a run for her money for being bitchy. But, they both got what they deserved in the end. But, like, she's just saying, dump him overboard and let's get the hell out of here. Rebecca Hall's character is saying, if we're going to survive this, you need to let him go so that we can have a fair fight on our hands. Because if he has two titans tied behind his back, he ain't got no shot.
Nah.
And they just like, nah, it'll be fine. Godzilla will just run around a couple of, he'll swim around. He won't do very much. Yeah.
Speaking of Rebecca Hall's character, she replaced Vera.
No, she didn't. She's too... Okay. There are two completely different characters.
Right. So I guess, why didn't they bring her back? That was Millie's mom.
I believe, I don't know why they didn't bring her back.
They had her picture on the bulletin board at some point.
I can't remember
the
exact.
Dad was there. And
well, because I haven't, so.
Out of left field.
I'm not the biggest fan of King of the Monsters because the monster fights are not. They're brilliant and they're great and they destroy all monsters, like, but they're not shot very well. Mm-hmm. And the plotting of that is very convoluted in that, like, woman decides to let all monsters loose. Woman then realizes letting all monsters loose has caused chaos and death of millions. Woman who let monsters loose now realizes her daughter is in danger and might be killed by said monster. Woman who let monsters out now feels bad.
Too many tropes, huh?
Well, it's just like her rationale makes no sense. So in the movie, her whole deal is I want to reboot the whole thing. This is their world. They're the Titans. We're the humans. We're ravaging the world with global warming and we're mucking it up. Let's let the Titans take back over. And she teams up with an eco-terrorist to do exactly that. Go throughout all of the Monarch because she knows we're all Monarchs keeping the monsters. Go to all of them and release them and let them go. And that's her whole plan. And she's all on board with it until her daughter becomes in harm's way. And then she's like, oh, shit, maybe I did something wrong. And so that's my whole deal is it's like her motivations don't work. The machinations of how she goes about things don't work. How you get to that point.
You need somebody who cares about Kong.
Right, and in this particular instance, you need a Kong whisperer as Rebecca Hall's character is dubbed, who has been on Skull Island for a decade in this habitat, working with him to kind of give you a sense of the modern Kong is because again, like Monarch sends the mission to Skull Island, they find Kong, they come back, Tom Hiddleston and Brie Larson's character, and they're like, this is an actual thing, and then they brief Monarch and. From then on, Monarch is aware of Kong, and eventually they send this guy, send this crew down there to build this habitat and study him and keep an eye on him. And so when the time comes for this fight to happen, you have a Godzilla expert and you have a Kong expert. And the Kong expert is more heavily leaned on because Godzilla's had two movies, whereas Kong's only had one. So.
A travesty. More Kong.
More Kong. Again, but I mean, I love Rebecca Hall. She's hot and she's a decent actress. It's just she just constantly ends up in these roles where she's nothing but either the pretty girl or she's exposition. and she's both in Iron Man 3. But what's the rest of your not so good?
That's really about all of it. You know, I like the movie so much. I'm nitpicking it here, trying to find something that's not so good.
Okay, well, my not so good would be the absolute dog pile that is the human characters. Well. Most of all, Molly Bobby Brown, whose dad is always gone, and all she has to do is call up her fat friend, and her fat friend will bring over the storm chaser van, and they'll get in the storm chaser van and drive across country to 17-year-olds absconding together in a van to drive across country to go meet a wacky podcast hosting paranoid dude. What part of this sounds like an adult should have stepped in and said, "Excuse me, not a good idea."
Brian, please. They had the easiest clue to follow, which was that he bought a lot of bleach.
A lot of bleach. And so they just walked around.
They're easy to find.
Easy to find. Plenty of stores. Plenty of stores in the Fort Lauderdale or the
Pensacola
area. Plenty of stores in the Pensacola area that have bleach. We're just going to keep going one after the other. Like, no one eventually called the cops and were like, "Hey, these kids are running around looking for people who buy a lot of bleach. You might want to take a look at them."
Yeah, you know.
Between dad literally just being there at the beginning and at the end and not being a parental figure at all.
He didn't have any point.
Except just to say, "Hey, Godzilla's going mad and we don't know why." Well, your first indication should be, again, he's a protector. There's an evil corporation or a corporation that's been mega, that like is spending millions of dollars in technology and resources on developing robot materials. You should have put two and two together that he wouldn't have just attacked that facility at random. There would have been a reason. But again, he shows up at the beginning and shows up at the end. He doesn't parents at all. Like, you know, even when he finds out that his daughter's in the same city, he doesn't go get his daughter. He just lets his daughter do whatever.
He's wandering through the streets of Hong Kong and just happens to walk right up on her.
Right. A very small city that Hong Kong is.
He was doing a lot of searching.
Yeah. Skarsgård is also a bother to me because all that dude is a hunky dude who has no acting skills. And his whole deal here is to look shocked, awed, and amazed. And he still gets the big hero moment at the end, recharging Kong's heart. And he does not earn it or deserve it. Cunning Asian bitch is hot and fun. And she has some of the best, like, funny deadpan moments of the movie, but I really would like more information on that little crazy dynamic there, because like it's obvious she's trying to win daddy's approval and daddy's obviously a raving lunatic madman. Mm-hmm. So like, how does the daughter grow up in that situation? And like, so I was interested in that. Where did the corporation come from? Because it's not mentioned in Kong Skull Island or in King of the Monsters. So just randomly this robot firm popped up and got mega important. So those would be my not so good. I love Molly Bobby Brown. I think she's going to be great going forward as she gets more adult roles. I'm really interested to see, as I told you yesterday, where her career goes as far as whether it's the Christina Ricci path or it's the, Anna Chlumsky path or it's the Anna Paquin path. You know, Anna Paquin went on to have a successful acting career for 15, 20 years after her childhood fame. Christina Ricci had some success as an adult and then faded out. And then Anna Chlumsky had My Girl 1 and 2, didn't grow boobs fast enough and was shucked away. And so she ended up going to Harvard and doing okay for herself. So yeah, like,
she'll be fine.
Yeah, so like, which one of the three pathways will she take? Is the interesting thing to me. But this role does not do her any sort of help or justice or anything. So.
Yeah. Probably just I don't know. It's all rumor. But I hear her dad pushes her pretty hard behind the scenes in the industry. So it's probably a paycheck thing. Well, probably a paycheck thing for him.
Well, they have large roles in both of them. Like, I'd say she has about as much screen time in this as she did in King of the Monsters, and it's a giant paycheck. But I just think she had more to do in King of the Monsters. But again, she's not. The other thing too that would be in my not so good. How the hell are we getting from Hong Kong, from Pensacola to Hong Kong in like the blink of an eye? Like, how are we moving shipping containers that fast? I mean, I know infrastructure has been pretty shitty even in their world.
They were using one of those magnetic.
Yeah.
Those, whatever ship they were in with the.
Yeah, they were using the
gravitational
tunnels.
Field.
Yeah, they were using tunnels, but again, how does one technology company have enough, you know, power and gravitas to build an underground tunnel from Pensacola to Hong Kong that can get your shipping containers there in less than 3 hours?
Yeah, I think they're trying to. I agree. I think they're trying to show you that they have that
technology, that
prowess, just by feeding you more of it, like with the spaceships that I was talking about. Oh, we have those spaceships, we have this tunnel, so surely a Mechagodzilla is not a big deal. You can believe that we created that.
Right. But and again...
Where did that come
from? Well, like, my favorite line in the movie is old homeboy is like, damn, it's a shame we'll never get to hear that speech.
Oh, yeah.
It's like...
That was pretty funny.
It's like we're in the middle of the classic villain speech where he explains his motivations and he gets mowed down halfway
through. By his own creation.
By his own creation halfway through. And it's like, okay, so basically what it comes down to is your idea was that humans are going to go, that she's going to get her way, that like the Titans will rule over the humans and it'll become their world again. And you're like, oh, no, humanity has always been dominant. We've been dominant since after the days of the dinosaurs. We should always remain top of the food chain. And so we will create a force that can be equal to Godzilla so that he can defeat Godzilla so that humans can have a defender. Not realizing that Godzilla is a defender of humans and not really looking to munch on them or rule over them as a, you know, non-benevolent king.
Let me tell you something. If they didn't break that satellite link to Mechagodzilla where he was getting all his power, I don't know how he was getting that via satellite, but he took care of Godzilla no problem. He would have handled Kong. I mean, that thing was brutal. It cut that, I can't remember the name of the monster from Skull Island.
But Skull Crawler.
The Skull Crawler just snatched that thing up and cut it in half.
Mm-hmm.
I mean.
But that was the whole thing. They had to go to Hollow Earth and get the power source because the power sources, the Earth man-made power sources they were using could only power the Mechagodzilla to 40%.
They needed that sample.
And they didn't know what the sample
from the motherland.
And they didn't know what the sample would do. And so they sent his son, he sent his other Asian son in there to, you know, guide the thing, and he, you know, blows his brains out by being electrocuted because it's just too much power.
Yeah.
So you go from
that's where I
you go from 40% to 110% essentially.
Yeah.
And so he's the Mechagodzilla is operating at 110%. It's like that scene in the original Avengers where Thor commands the lightning.
Yeah, yeah.
Thor commands the lightning and hits Iron Man's suit and then Iron Man it charges Iron Man's suit to 400% and he fires back. Same kind of thing.
Yeah, I think that's back to the Mechagodzilla. I think that's where the Pacific Rim came in so heavy with me. I mean, it was the colors and the... Yeah. It was the guy behind the scenes in the helmet controlling the...
Yeah, it had a very... But again, like Mechagodzilla has been a thing for a long time in the Toho movies. So you could also argue as big of a film fan as Guillermo del Toro is, that he would have been influenced by that as well.
Yeah, I guess we keep beating up the human characters and some of the human decisions and some of the bad plot holes or plot lines.
But I mean, if a couple guys come to you as a disgraced scientist and you're like, we'll give you a whole bunch of money if you come work for us and do this bad thing. And you're just like, okay, I'll go get my girl and we'll go do this thing.
Yeah, why not?
It's like, you know, what do you got to lose? I mean, you're already got book, you know, boxes of books that you can't sell. What else are you gonna do?
Well, I guess if you're, I mean, one of my good things was that it was all about the monsters and not as much about the people. But I guess that to to have that, you got to sacrifice some of the exposition, like you were saying. You got to have the evil villain who, I mean, did you care when he was killed? I mean, it was funny that he got killed during his big evil speech. No big deal. You know, didn't care that his daughter was killed. It wasn't satisfying to watch these guys go down because, in my opinion, they weren't the real villain. It was, by that point, Mechagodzilla.
Mm-hmm. And again, it's the human character there to get you to from beat to beat to beat.
Mm-hmm.
The human character's there to get you from one fight to the next fight to the final fight.
And yeah, sprinkling a little bit of evil with some of them, right, to create some tension.
Mm-hmm. So what was your bad?
Basically, I mean, I started to get into it there. No investment at all in the human characters. And I mean, I don't...
Which you have in Kong Skull Island. You have in Kong Skull Island. And you have to an extent in Garris... And Garris Godzilla 14, because you care about Elizabeth Olsen and, mm-hmm, and you're concerned about Aaron Taylor Johnson and you know it's basically a one man's journey to get back home dealing with daddy issues. There's thematic relevance there. There's thematic relevance with, you know, what Brie Larson's doing and what Tom Hiddleston's doing and all of the things. You care about Sam Jackson in that movie.
Sam Jackson was brutal.
You don't care about these people because this corporation has no background. It has no history. You don't know who this guy is, just that he's rich and, you know.
And nothing, you know, they have these big moments where the bad guys die and but who cares?
No.
You know, it didn't get any,
mm-hmm,
didn't elicit any response.
Except
it's like,
laugh.
All right, what's next? Get back to the real fight.
Except to laugh.
Yeah.
Like the it's funny when the both of the deaths are played for laughs. The daughter's death when the space shuttle gets eaten, and the father when he's giving his evil speech. Both deaths are played for laughs, because you can't play him for dramatic stakes. Like you can argue that the most danger any human character is in is that little girl who's being put into all of these dangerous situations by these adults for no other reason than their own benefit.
Mm-hmm. Well, speaking of the jokes, I thought those were kind of bad. I didn't really find it funny. Did you? I mean, it was just kind of like the first thing you see, Kong wakes up and scratching his butt, walking up, you know, in his little containment field. It's not really that funny. The whole thing about she's signing the word coward and he thinks it means he's very brave. I mean... It got you a call back at the end.
Yeah, and it's small and it's funny, but like the main human character that's supposed to be comedic relief is our African American friend who's doing the Crazy Paranoid podcast. Mm-hmm. And while I like that dude, he's going to be in Eternals in November.
Oh, okay.
And he's also, I know you didn't see it, very many people didn't, but the Child's Play remake that I enjoyed, he was also in that. And he was also in Joker. He was the clerk at Arkham who refuses to give Arthur his mother's medical records, and then Arthur takes.
I didn't notice.
Yeah, that's who that guy is, and he's a good character actor, and he's really really funny. It's just the humor doesn't necessarily work, but you know there are bits that work, and that's all I can really ask for. I mean. There are lines in Armageddon that don't work.
Well, of course.
But there are ones that stick with me. I mean, we're, you know...
Don't want to pay taxes again, ever.
Yeah, that one, the one that I always go back to is the leaving on a jet plane.
Oh, he's singing it.
Yeah, and or the early scene where the asteroid, the little chunks of asteroids are entering the atmosphere and hitting New York. And the taxi driver jumps out of his cab and says, "Saddam Hussein be bombing us."
Oh, yeah.
Which right. Which is a reference that only works in 1999, 98, pre-9/11.
Mm-hmm.
Like, but there, the strip club scene, you know, there are certain things that's humor, bits of humor. Bashumi is awesome for that in that movie. But, like, the humor works just enough to... liven the situation from the tension of Harry and, you know, the world-ending consequences of what they're going to do. They're on a pass-fail mission here.
Mm-hmm. suicide mission.
Right. Well, they're on, not even that. They're on a pass-fail mission. Mm-hmm. It's just like the Deep Impact also came out that same year. It's they're different kinds of movies, but they're telling the same story, which is these folks are on a succeed or fail mission, and the entire bit of humanity is riding on them. Like, if they screw up, this asteroid hits Earth, everybody's done.
Yeah.
And it doesn't matter if they come back or not. They want anything to come back to if they're not successful. And so that's a really heavy premise when... And Deep Impact obviously plays it more dramatically than Armageddon does. But Armageddon is great at livening that up. Independence Day, same deal. Must go faster. You know, you don't think they spent $20,000 on a toilet, $5,000 for a hammer. Mm-hmm. You know, it's, you know, I've got to get me one of these. trying to think of another one. You know, when he punches the alien and
Welcome to Earth,
you know, but those things liven the mood from the more serious moments of having to evacuate the White House just before it blows up. And I think that this movie succeeds in that it uses those, especially like the coward moment at the end, where it's meant to liven the mood from this very dark, very heavy, like nearly fatal situation, which I think it does really well with.
That's really all I got for bad, and that's a stretch. Well, I enjoyed the movie too. I was too much of a fan.
I enjoyed the movie too. My bad. There were a few things. One, again, the Skull Island thing. Okay, a storm took it over, so we just built this quarantine chamber so we could keep an eye on Kong.
A terrarium for Kong.
Right. That he destroys regularly, by the way, by just projecting trees.
He's throwing the trees through there, yeah.
So they're constantly having to repair it. The little things about how, you know, the Evil Corporation. Evil Corporation is not named or mentioned in either one of the two previous movies. You know, they say that a storm took over Skull Island. Well, when did it take over Skull Island? Why would a storm perpetually be hovering over the island? Is it Ghidorah? Is, you know, they don't really explain it. They just kind of brush over it as a reason why they had to build the Terra Dome. The fact that they sent a squad into the Hollow Earth to evaluate it, and that they got crushed and destroyed, and that the dude's brother is just like, sign me up.
Was he on that first? Do I understand him to be a sole survivor of that?
I don't think he was the sole survivor. I think he was guilt-ridden because his brother was on it.
Okay.
And I think they were both supposed to be on it, and he ended up being the only one that went, and then he never came back.
Gotcha, okay.
But again, that's all inferred stuff.
I remember wondering, how did you survive then?
But... Yeah. That's all inferred stuff. The other thing that my bad would also be that, like, again, you put your young daughter who you adopted into multiple bad situations for your own benefit, and you're hard and steadfast when the black guy tells you, hey, let's take Kong off the island because we can't really keep affording to patch these holes in the wall. He's eventually going to get out. And, you know, you're steadfast and stern with, no, it's Godzilla would sense him. It would be bad. Blonde-haired, blue-eyed Tarzan dude shows up, and you're like, okay.
What was his reasoning? It was that they found a way to Hollow Earth and they could get him home.
Yeah.
She didn't want to risk it, but eventually, about 30 seconds later, says, yeah, no problem. Yeah, that was a bit abrupt.
Very abrupt when you have the scene earlier in the film of her flatly denying it under the same premise. The other bad for me would be the fact that homegirl, like, doesn't realize her daughter can sign and doesn't realize that she's been talking to Kong. That she just kind of knows they have a kind of a connection or some kind.
That might go hand in hand with her putting her daughter in tough situations, like you said. She just...
Yeah, we're just going to leave you out here on this side here.
Not as good at parenting as you might
No.
Has no idea that she can communicate with the Titan.
Oh, wait. So the last guys who did this got crushed because the gravity was so much? Let me put take me and my daughter on this trip.
Yeah, I'll go. I didn't. Yeah, that wouldn't even... I guess by that point, I was into the movie. Just show me the next battle. I can't wait to see Hollow Earth. You know there's going to be more of this.
That's what I want. We want to end our podcast close our podcast talking about the future of the MonsterVerse. This movie is now on pace to make as much, if not more, than the two gods, the Godzilla and Kong movies that came before it. The trend had been going downward, box office wise, just simply because of things, mainly these being big summer tent poles and things, tons of things around them. But it's on pace, even in a COVID environment, to make a lot of money. And the writers and the director are out there talking about visions and ideas they have and background information on the axe and the Hollow Earth and things that they...
Mm-hmm. They left just enough to dig into.
Well, the Hollow Earth shots at the end were meant to be a post-credit stinger originally.
Really?
And they re-edited them to put them into the film. But
I wondered why we didn't get that. I just knew there was going to be something.
And that's because the Hollow Earth thing with him running around and swinging and all that was supposed to be an indication that, you know, that Kong's new home is Hollow Earth. And so any sequel we would get to Kong Skull Island would include...
You know that's coming.
Yeah. Well, hopefully. Do you want to see more? Do you not want to see more?
Oh, absolutely.
And
I'll go see anything with King Kong in the theater. I just like the story. I like the fantasy part of it. I like that there's dinosaurs still there. Land of the Lost, like you said. I was a little disappointed. I should have mentioned this. You don't get to see any of his family. You know, I was kind of rooting for there to be some family there, or at least some more of his own kind.
But I mean, I think the idea there was, it's a bad example to use, but like how many Jews were actually still present in Jerusalem 80 years ago when the United Kingdom and the United States helped form the nation of Israel in Jerusalem after the events of World War II? There weren't nearly as many as there are now, but that's the ancestral homeland. And so
they find their way back home.
And so the idea was, this is the ancestral homeland. These bad things happen to us. If you give us this ancestral homeland back, we'll have a place where we can go where we won't have to worry about fear of being persecuted or destroyed like we were in World War II. Let's not even, you know, talk about or worry about the other folks who were there. But the majority of them were Palestinians. Mm-hmm. It's the same kind of way I feel like with Kong Skull Island. It is, or with Hollow Earth. It is both Godzilla and Kong's ancestral homeland. It is where the Titans were birthed, where they roamed, and how they made their way to the crust and back. And so there were wars, there were battles, there were things. Kong is the last of his descendants. Godzilla's the last of his. And this is just their ancestral homeland. That the throne he took was his father's and his great-grandfather's and his grandfather's throne, and it belonged to him. And that's why Godzilla freaked out the moment that axe got put in the right place, because it signaled to him that the king was back.
You're thinking we might get some prequels.
Could. You could also go into a situation where Kong has to battle for supremacy of, you know, the Black Pantherness of it all, right? A new Black Panther has to battle to prove himself worthy against an opponent who would challenge. Who's to say that someone doesn't want to come after the new King Kong sitting on his throne to dethrone him?
As soon as they got him in there, creatures started attacking him. You know, there's more fun stuff to be had there. That's where some of your new monsters could come.
Because you're not grounded by Toho's catalog. You can literally do whatever. And And it'd be interesting, because I think that Morris has a financial decision to make.
That sounds like a mostly Kong movie, which is fine with me.
And I don't know what you do with Godzilla at this point, because You've had the two movies. You've established him as a protector of Earth. You now have Kong below on Hollow Earth. So any kind of threat that would come from Hollow Earth up to the surface would have to go through Kong first to make it to Godzilla. And any kind of like man-made thing would now basically, I think, be gone, because pretty sure the government would now be like, okay, let's ban like more robot development technology. Like, we're not going to keep doing this. So like, I feel like you wouldn't get into another Mad Lab situation where like Mutos would be laying eggs places and Godzilla would have to, cause that was the whole thing in the first one, right? That eggs hatched in a Muto, in a Mutos hatched in a Monarch facility. So like, we already have established in King of the Monsters that the government is monitoring and being a very tight leash on Monarch. We know that, you know, newspaper cat that poops out future newspaper guy, Friday Night Lights guy's character is now the head of Monarch. So Monarch would keep a close eye and make sure that shit like that doesn't happen again. So really, Kong is the only way you get a sequel. And then, as with the Avengers, another threat has to arrive that is disconcerting enough.
Maybe something that didn't know it could travel from Hollow Earth through. Right.
Something.
Let's see, I can write this stuff.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it really is, because you're not constrained to reality. You're not constrained to, that's the beauty of science fiction. Why something like Blade Runner 2020, the Blade Runner films work so well, is because you're not bound. Dune is the ultimate example of that. Just absolutely bananas, balls to the walls mix of sci-fi, fantasy, and Roman literature. I mean, it's just an amalgamation of different things, but you're not bound by rules and by normal constraints. Now, some of that has changed. Comic books are wacky and off the wall, but you still have to have grounded rules for them when you come and make movies, because the expectations for audiences are different. For example, death. Death in the comic books means absolutely jack shit.
Yeah.
Death is only as permanent as the next author. You can't really do that in film, because people want stakes, and it really removes stakes if you feel like there's no danger of your characters being...
Gotta have the stakes.
Right. So, but you're hopeful that they do more. I'm hopeful they do more. I'd like to see some film end up somewhere around the 500 million worldwide mark. It's well on its way there.
Almost to 300, right?
I'd like to see it end up somewhere around 500. Give them a real reason under COVID circumstances. Now, the downside to this, if I'm in a boardroom and we're discussing what the future of this property, my answer to that is going to be, look at the circumstances surrounding it. It was the only thing. It was the first thing in about a year. If you do this again, it will be in a May or a August or a March, where there will be eight other things within 5 weeks of it on either side. And the marketplace will be way more crowded, and you won't make nearly as much. And these films are not cheap to make. This film was budgeted at $130 million.
I didn't know that.
Which is a drop in the bucket compared to, you know, the $300 million you spend to make a Star Wars movie. But
yeah, but Star Wars is...
$1 billion guaranteed. Yeah. Or should be $1 billion guaranteed.
It still will be.
But I'm anxious to see more. I'm looking forward to seeing what Warner Brothers does from there. So any other thoughts on the world of film and movies and media before we go? We enjoy having you on, Steven.
Yeah, thank you. Keep the theaters open. Keep them coming. Please give us some more content to the theaters. I think more is on the way. And bring me James Bond immediately. Can we please get him out of the mothballs and put him back up? I'm ready. I'll go see that tomorrow.
I love the fact that my popcorn tin had the April 2020 date for James Bond.
Oh, that's right. They're still doing the old marketing material when we were in the theater, not even a week ago.
Still had the April date on it.
Gotta save money.
Was originally supposed to be a November 2019 release date.
I was ready.
Got moved to April.
Yeah, I can't.
Then got moved from April to November. Then got moved from November to the next April. And then now has been moved from April to the following November.
Yeah, but don't get me started. That is a flick that will always get me to the theater.
And I think that there are certain brands that will still draw people to the theater. I'm going to be interested to see what the Mortal Kombat numbers are now. I mean, it's 3 weeks from now. It's the end of April. I'm going to be really interested to see if those numbers are as strong as the Kong Godzilla numbers, because we both know Mortal Kombat has a following, and that original movie back in 95 was not bad. So it's going to be interesting to see if those numbers are positive. Maybe more studios creep their dates back up instead of pushing them further away.
Going to the movies on the weekend, or, you know, on a night where you don't have anything to do, that's just ingrained in our culture. I think they got to get it stoked back up and it'll be fine. I really do.
I mean, I get where they were coming from, though. I sat in those theaters for many a Thursday night premiere where there were 8 or 10 of us. Like I said, I haven't seen a crowd that large at a theater premiere since Star Wars.
Yeah.
I mean, and that's the thing. You can still get people out for big events, and they made this a big event. The question is, what happens? What do you get when you put Judas and the Black Messiah, or opening night for Tom and Jerry, or opening night for Space Jam 2, A New Legacy? Will you get those people out for those? And that's the thing. That's the problem.
I don't think you will.
Especially in a climate where every studio has 7 major tentpoles they're going to release every year. So they're, you know, not everything can be this big, massive event that the new Marvel movie or the new Star Wars movie is. And, you know, it's all about setting your expectations.
They're going to need a bunch of blockbusters to jumpstart it.
Good blockbusters, too.
Yep.
All right, that'll about do it for this week's podcast. You can follow me on Twitter. I am at BCW Tiger Fan. Chad is at The Mets Theory, and I am officially the Stan account for all things Mark Sanchez.
Oh, geez.
Thank you very much, and have a pleasant evening.